Just when I needed them most, there they go. Isn't that the way? They'll be back. They have to be back. They're contractually obligated to be back. So. Any news you've been following this week? I feel like in the room, it's just like there's this desire to talk about abortion. And I'm not going to talk about it. In fact, I taught ethics to undergraduates for a long, long time. And of course, abortion being a hot button topic, we always talked about it. And then when I moved to the business college, I thought, and was teaching graduate students, I thought, oh, great, I'll never have to talk about abortion again. Wrong. So it did make me think of C3, though, in this sense, and that is, excuse me, guys want to come up? Just being grateful for an institution, a group like this. I know a lot of you work really hard to keep C3 not just going, but thriving. And an organization, a group of people like you, obviously will be crucial to what is coming up in terms of whatever fights, policy decisions, protests, demonstrations, letters to the editors, organizing, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm grateful that you let us be part of it, and we look forward to continuing to be part of it. So thank God for C3, can I say that? Okay, to my right here, Sonia and Charlotte DeWild, who are going to sort of punctuate some of what I have to say here today. I understand a month or so ago, Kelly Parker was here. He brought four bright and shiny Grand Valley undergraduates. The best I could do was scrounge up a couple of teenagers. But I'm pretty fond of them. What we lack in quantity, we'll try to make up for in sheer volume. So see if that, how that works. Okay, so Leslie called me and said, we want to come out and talk about the earth. I said, sure, can you be any more specific than that? No, just talk about the earth. Oh, okay, that narrows it down, thanks. I'll just go from there. So the context for this is we have been developing a course called Philosophy and Business, because a lot of the undergraduates who come to us in their junior and senior year don't have a good grounding or background, understanding of where capitalism came from, where business came from, what it means. And so we're trying to rectify that a little bit. So we've been reading a fair bit in a book that we're going to use in the course, The Mind and the Market by Jerry Muller. And I might fumble through and try to find some passages to read. And I've been reading especially lately in Voltaire and Adam Smith, and I'm going to do something I don't always or even often do, and that is sing the praises of early modern capitalism. So, the readings will lead us into that, I hope, to suggest, A, self-interest is a facet of human nature. It's evolutionarily designed for, you can't escape it. You would be hard-pressed to survive without it. It's a good thing that it's there, though it also can be corrupted and used for all sorts of purposes that are detrimental to humans. But I'm going to sing the praises a little bit too of self-interest as we go along before we get to the conclusion, in which I bring in a 78-year-old curmudgeonly Czech earth scientist named Václav Šmíl, who was interviewed last week in Sunday's Times, but known about for a long time, who says, we're all doomed, but not maybe not. Don't box me in, man. So it'll be an interesting note to end on, I think. So here's Voltaire from the 18th century. It's as impossible for society to be formed and lasting without self-interest as it would be to produce children without carnal desire or to think of eating without appetite. It's love of self that encourages love of others. It's through our mutual needs that we are useful to the human race. That's the foundation of all commerce, the eternal link between men. He's writing in the 18th century, men is what he means. Without it, not a single art would have been invented, no society of 10 people formed. It's the self-love that every animal has received from nature, which warns us to respect that in others as well. And then Naomi Klein, I'm sure many of you are familiar with, writes a lot on climate and capitalism. This book, This Changes Everything, Capitalism Versus the Climate, she says, And I wish I'd thought of this before she said it. It seemed so obvious when she said it, because I think I had drunk the Kool-Aid like most people I know. Oh, we have the fate of the earth in our hands. It's like, no, we don't. And I think she says that in a way that's both striking and useful. When we marvel at that blue marble in all of its delicacy and frailty and resolve to save the planet, we cast ourselves in a very specific role. That role is of a parent, the parent of the earth. But the opposite is the case. It's we humans who are fragile and vulnerable, and the earth that is hardy and powerful and holds us in its hands. In pragmatic terms, our challenge is less to save the earth from ourselves, more to save ourselves from an earth that, if pushed too far, has ample power to rock, burn, and shake us off completely. That knowledge should inform all that we do. Like I said, to me at least, when I read that, I'm slow. It took me a while to get that. I have an anthropocentric view of the world in which I am all-powerful and forget occasionally that the earth mocks that at every opportunity. All right, early stage capitalism. What were the luxury goods that presaged the advent of a growing transoceanic market capitalism, the growth of the stock exchange in Amsterdam and the Royal Stock Exchange in London, the East India companies, the opportunity for us, the common people, to begin to participate in a growing economy and gain a level of prosperity that allowed us to not only gain our necessities more readily, but in fact, things that had only been available to the nobility, aristocracy, or notably the church before the advent of all this. So again, we're talking Voltaire, early 18th century, so first part of the 1700s, and Adam Smith, which I'll refer to also, latter part of the 18th century. Voltaire is writing about things that, whatever your view of capitalism these days, and those of you who might be budding Marxists, you can take me to task later, either at talkback or at home. we have that conversation. Nonetheless, Voltaire is setting himself up against this in this era, right, of just endless religious factionalism, warring, a Europe torn apart by theological and theocratic differences and problems, and wants to argue for this growing market capitalism on the basis of at least two claims, one anti-clerical, one the other sort of the predominant civic way of thinking at the moment. He says, look, you know, the author Muller, commenting on Voltaire, says, you know, to us right now, material well-being, that's not exactly controversial, right? We know we need to find renewables, readjust a little bit, but nobody's going to argue against material well-being. It gives us a level of freedom, comfort, health, education, sociability that, you know, is unprecedented in human history. That comes directly from Voltaire. That's everything he's arguing for. He said, enough of the religious intolerance, enough of the religious factionalism. Said this notion that we should have our eye on the prize, some otherworldly, after we suffer greatly, you know, we should be pious, we should be frugal, we should be in self-denial, we should do all the kinds of things. His argument about that is, look, what did a monk ever add to anybody's, you know, social index? Said, how is a monk actually useful? So he's, you know, at some point, because he's writing like this, he gets asked, I said this earlier in the pre-talk, he said he gets asked to leave France. And Dick looked at me and said, you know, he didn't get asked to leave France. He was running for his life because they were going to chop his head off. I said, yeah, I know. He ends up in England, which he really likes a lot. He said, there's all these religious, this tolerance, or he goes to the stock exchange, there are all these people from all over the world who represent different cultures and religions. They have one thing in mind, not to convince each other of who's right or wrong about religion, but to make money, to trade. He said, this is a good thing. This makes men gentler, more sociable. And Adam Smith echoes this, and I don't know if he takes this directly from Voltaire or not, but they both say, look, you want a gentle, you want a more civilized, you want a more enlightened society, get people to trade with one another over long distances. He said, as opposed to making them all camp out next to people who don't believe the same things that they do. commerce, those interests of commerce, will trump ideological commitments in the long run. And as people see that their material well-being is also improving, they will relax a little bit about extending that same privilege to others, and you get a kind of, as you said, gentility that you don't have in almost all of human history before that. And think about this. I'm not a numbers guy, but this one kind of stands out to me. So give or take a few thousand, there have been about 12,000 generations of humans who are appreciably like us, look like us, have the kind of same brain capacity we have. So depending upon your evolutionary theory, somewhere between 130 and 200,000 years of people like us, humans, right? And during that time, right, we've only really been struggling with this question of the effects, self-consciously struggling with the effects we have on the environment for maybe a couple of hundred years. So only 1% of our time as humans have we really been thinking about the effects that we've had, the level of consciousness about that. So Voltaire, Adam Smith, laborers, Hutchinson, Addison, I mean, this whole group of people who are both thinkers and workers, laborers, saying great, greater prosperity, meted out to far more people than ever before in human history. This is an amazing, great thing. Let's go for it. You can excuse them, I think, for thinking, of course, this is great. This is the dawn of a new human era 250 years ago. Said, we're going to be, have, and do things we've never been able to do as human beings in our history through technological innovation, through liberty, and through conceptualizing the economy in market terms, early modern capitalism. It's a great thing. Voltaire should get a lot of credit for that. He does. And he goes on to say that in this abundance, growing abundance, meted out to more people, especially in England first, France comes later, abundance is the mother of the arts. Material prosperity was the prerequisite for the development of higher civilization, and that would henceforth be repeated by virtually every advocate of enlightened thinking and economic thinking through our time. We're still both celebrating and, I think, wrestling with the ideas that Voltaire and Smith introduced to us 250 years ago.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Oh, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
Oh, they're not done. They'll have more to say. Okay. Smith comes along. Doesn't even think of himself as primarily a political scientist or economist, but as a moral theorist, a moral philosopher, right? Writes the theory of moral sentiments and then the Wealth of Nations after that. And his thinking is, again, a break with most of human history. How do we get beyond this notion of self-denial, like Voltaire, and use the self-interest that nature has bequeathed us with to develop an economy that allows us to think of ourselves as being okay with pursuing happiness as a worldly pursuit, as a political goal? It's all right to want to be happy. It's all right. And what's the prerequisite for happiness? Whatever else it might be, it's got to be some level of material well-being, right? Hard to find anybody on the planet to this day who says, yeah, living in squalor or deprivation, yeah, you know, I'm happy in my mind. Have a rich interior life. Not many of those folks around, right? And that's pretty well backed up by Maslow and et al., okay? But Smith wants to go beyond that. He says, look, this is not about just being better off. This is about being better humans. Capitalism, commercial economy, the way he's thinking about it, said, will better our condition. How? So I'm going to read this passage because I'm asking you to think about it. And again, I think you'll see the legacy of this in our own time. At the root of our attempt to better our condition is the desire to be observed, to be attended to be taken notice of with sympathy and approval, right? He goes on to say, it's really difficult to do that. If you're a laborer with no shoes, very few clothes, if you've been working in the fields, if you're indentured, if you've got very little access to even the lowest strata of what the nobility, the courts, the clergy has, said, hard to think of yourself and then with dignity, and then hard to think of others of thinking of you with dignity as well. So Smith's argument is one from the dignity and worth of the individual granted to him or her through material well-being. The better off men appear, the more likely they are to get the attention and approval of others. The dominant motive for economic activity, take care of the necessities, was beyond that the eminently impalpable desire for social status. Now, we downplay that, right? It's like, oh, keeping up with the Joneses, or, you know, my students, oh, you know, who cares, right? It's like, well, what are you in school for? Oh, you know, to get a job. Oh, well, what do you want a job for? Oh, you know, to make money, you know. For what? So I can buy cool stuff. You know? Well, why do you want cool stuff? Well, is it all intrinsic satisfaction? I think Smith is onto something here when he says it's not all intrinsic, you know. It's just, you know, I can just sit with my shiny objects forever in my own room, never show them off, and be perfectly content. He said, I don't think so. So there's an argument from dignity here in terms of having what once were considered bare necessities become, or I'm sorry, the other way around, what once were considered luxuries become necessities. He tells a story about the road workers in England, mid-1700s. And tea was something that only the upper class, right, the nobility had access to. But by 1750, 1760, the road workers are taking tea by the side of the road, you know? It's like, it's not just the luxury or the feeling or the pure intrinsic pleasure of the tea. It's a sign, it's a symbol to everybody else. Look, we're on the rise. We deserve this. We enjoy it. We get it. We can incorporate it into our lives, and it makes our lives better because you see and have to treat us with a greater level of respect and dignity than you did before. It's the advent of greater individual autonomy and liberty. And again, we can talk about where that led. But at the time, right, as a reaction to both feudal and court society, that's a huge leap forward. And the luxury goods at this time, again, are cocoa, tea, coffee, silk, porcelain, in England, increasingly cookware, the kinds of things that we would take for granted now that you can buy over and over without thinking about it. It's interesting, I'd say as an aside, moving forward, what would you say are luxury goods now? And if I frame it that way, you say, well, the material goods, well, Mercedes, or, you know, the country house, or whatever it might be. I think for an increasing number of people, luxury goods these days would be time and privacy. And if you look at what the wealthy are buying, who they are reaching out to plan their vacations, privacy and time are the two things that they're looking for more than anything else. Where can you take me off the grid? Nobody else knows about. I'll still be comfortable, but I won't have to put up with the hoi polloi, right? The rich are forever looking for ways to distance themselves from the rest of us, right? We're all gravitating towards devices. They're moving away from them. The other luxury good that I would want to mention that we'll have to, we talked about this in the pre-talk, and it'll take some overcoming of basic wired human nature, but would be an ability to think about the future, which again is what material well-being does give you, the opportunity for a little bit of leisure in which you can pursue education and beyond that employ parts of your brain that, or, you know, to think about what might be coming in the future. Smith clearly understanding that, you know, this desire for wealth, status, leading to happiness is probably a delusion, but at the same time is offers us a level of dignity we haven't had before, says this: it is that deception which rouses and keeps in continual motion the industry of mankind. It's this which first prompted them to cultivate the ground, to build houses, to found cities and commonwealths, and to invent and improve all the sciences and arts which ennoble and embellish human life.
which have entirely changed the whole face of the globe, have turned the rude forests of nature into agreeable and fertile plains, and made the trackless and barren ocean a new fund of subsistence, the great high road of communication to the different nations of the earth. The earth, by these labors of mankind, has been obliged to redouble her natural fertility and to maintain a greater multitude of inhabitants.
They took all the trees, put them in a tree museum, and they charged the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Oh, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, believe me, the birds and the bees. Please, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
All right, so I don't have to tell you the legacy of early capitalism, as great as it was for material prosperity, has led us to the conundrum we face now, right? Which I don't have to educate anybody about. Everybody's always interested in the solutions rather than talking more about it. So I turned to Vaclav Smil, the great earth scientist, Czech descent, in an interview with him, like as I mentioned in the New York Times. I wish I could make it sound more hopeful than he does. So I'm going to end with his pessimistic last statement and then work my way back. The interviewer says, you know, look, isn't there a lot of progress being made, right? This dominion over the earth, this legacy of the extractive capitalism, taking things out of the earth. You all know the statistic, I'm sure. Americans need 6 Earths per year to provide us with all the resources that we use, right? If you just take Americans, you said, well, how much are we taking of the Earth's resources, you know, and then how much do we need? I said, well, we take 6 times what's available every year. We say, well, how is that possible? Right, how is that possible? Right. France, we were just in France visiting friends there, and the French are operating at a pace in which they would require, at their level of consumption, 4 Earths per year for all the resources. So we said, great, well, we'll move to France then, because, you know, they're 2 times less than we are. We could feel good about ourselves at that case. But we're talking with our French friends, and it was interesting. They lived here for 4 years, and they moved back to France. They could have stayed here, good job. And he said, well, why? You know, why did you move back to France, my home country, blah, 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 all that stuff. He said, but the other thing that they said to us over dinner one night was, he said, well, if we stayed in the United States, he said, us, the 2 of us, they're in their early 40s, and their kids are all teenagers now, he said, money really is the measuring stick. Money, it really is sort of the dominant ethos. He said, and, you know, for all the troubles France has, he said, it's not true there. So we're moving back to France. We don't want our kids raised in a culture where everything is denominated by denominations, as it were. And so they moved back. And we're talking one night at dinner, and some of this was in translation, so I think we got it right. But the kids were talking about, you know, who's rich and who's not rich and what that means. And in a place like Forest Hills, where we live, it means a lot, right? And rich is not a slur. Rich is not a pejorative. But the kids in France said, oh, man, you call somebody rich in France. I said, that's one of the lowest of the lows. I said, you're taking them out at the knees. I said, I'm not rich. You can't call me rich. What's the matter? You know, it's a whole different way of thinking about that, which suggests that culturally things can change, the way we conceptualize things change, and maybe we need to do some of that over time. The interviewer says, you know, things are changing. Indonesia has made a commitment to electric vehicles. Thailand's doing this, et cetera, solar. And the guy says, look, you know, Smil says, of course, the more photovoltaics, the better.
However, to have photovoltaics on a large scale, you have to have interconnections. If the country doesn't have a grid or has a weak national grid, how are you going to do it? You know, we don't even have a good, strong grid, so don't talk to me about Thailand, Nigeria, or these other places. And the interviewer, trying desperately, right, to wring some hope from this interview, says, okay, well, maybe not today, but tomorrow. He says, not tomorrow. He said, look, it's the scale. He says to the interviewer, you've become a victim. He said, it's inevitable because you're living in it, you're soaked in it, you're in New York City, this pushing people to one side or the other. We don't need pushing to the sides. What we need is the dull, factually correct, and accurate middle, because only from that middle will come the solutions. Solutions never come from extremes. It's irresponsible to state the problem in ways where, when you look closer, it's not like that. There are these billions of people right now who want to burn more fossil fuel. They will burn it unless you give them something different. But who will give them something different? You have to recognize the realities of the world, and the realities of the world tend to be unpleasant, discouraging, and depressing. And he knows more about this probably than just about anybody else on the planet. But what he's saying is, A, you know, there is, in the rest of the interview and others too, that I will end on this note, that I think actually, you know, may lend some air of hope to the future of humanity, is people like this want to move us away from the kind of mythologizing of the past or this notion of the future in which either one government entity or the raised consciousness of the people restores the earth so the earth doesn't turn on us in the way that Klein is talking about. In the middle of that, the way to that is to think about our own self-interest, right? Don't think about it. He says, it's not helpful to think about it. My grandchildren, I have to do this for my grandchildren. I have to do this for the people of India. I have to, you know. It's like, what's your self-interest? That's be the strongest, it always has been and always will be, the strongest, most reliable motivating factor for doing, finally, what's right. So if it's carbon sequestration, if it's photovoltaics, whatever it might be in the end, right, supporting those Voltaires and Smiths and all the inventors and all of the industrious entrepreneurs and all those folks who have a vision of the future that is in which we are both better and better off is the way to be thinking about this. Because wouldn't it be one of the great epic ironies of history, right, is if we stare at the future with an array of luxury goods unimaginable and unparalleled in human history, and yet the very land, air, and water that all those are dependent upon literally leave us gasping for those very things. So.
Late last night I heard the screen door slam, and a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? They pay paradise, put up a parking lot. They pay paradise, put up a parking lot. Yeah, they pay paradise, put up a parking lot.